Thank you, Thomas, and thank you for this wonderful invitation. It's been marvelous coming here, and it's been an honor and a privilege. Bonjour. The identification and articulation of a demonic world within any one of the religious traditions of the ancient Near East directly bears on the questions of how the ancients imagined and managed the powers of good and evil as they were expressed in personified form and fashion. Also, how these influenced human existence, human nature, and human destiny. And finally, how these impacted similar articulations within the so-called descendant Western traditions and beyond. What I aim to do here today is to present three distinct but convergent lines of evidence in an attempt to answer the question, was there a pandemonium in early Israel? Or was there an early Israelite pandemonium? I explore this question in part as a direct response to recent critiques casting doubt upon, and as a result, reopening again, the age-old question of whether or not a demonic world had been conceptualized in early Israel and Judah and articulated in the Hebrew Bible. In order to set the needed historical context, I will first sketch ever so briefly a praxis on demons from representative sectors of the wider ancient Near East. Then I will review again, in an ever so short resume, what we can know, demonological speaking, from the epigraphic, archaeological, and art historical data of Israel Judah spanning the second half of the Iron Age, that is 1000 to 500 BCE, more or less. With these two contested parameters of the ancient Near Eastern demonic world in hand, I will then reassess the relevant textual data from the Hebrew Bible against this socio-historical backdrop, using a sample text from the book of Deuteronomy. But before we delve into all that, we must also take up the matter of how I use the terms demon and demonic. As a provisional working definition, I follow those who have adopted the pre-Christian or the non-Christian, or better, non-dualistic use of the Greek term daimon, in its most inclusive sense, to refer to any kind of supernatural and divine entity. Daimon, therefore, will serve as my term of entry into the world of Levantine demons. The Greek daimon, despite any shortcomings as a heuristic construct, has in fact surely served reliably in such a capacity over the centuries. It's quite clear that the Greek daimon could refer to high gods, various intermediary beings, even ghosts of the dead. And in all and every case, these could be supernatural beings that acted for good or for evil. Conversely, I will invoke the modern English cognate, demon, only when I am referring to those inimical beings of a much later dualistic orientation, loaded as it is with the many centuries of entirely negative, and I gloss here, wholly evil connotations. First, the textual and iconographic evidence for demons in the wider ancient Near East. In the Egyptian and Mesopotamian languages, there is no one word that approximates the Greek daimon. Rather, there are only numerous epithets and collective names, such as messengers or wanderers. In Egyptian writing, the elusiveness of the daimonic is all the more evident as some of the supernatural beings that fall under that category are accompanied by the same determinative or marker of semantic category that is employed for designating the names of gods. When a specifically malevolent daimon is in view, another determinative could be used, representing a slain enemy. Or the name of an ill-disposed being could be rendered in red ink. In Mesopotamian texts, several terms might translate as daimon, such as Rabitsu, Galu, Yutuku, each of which can be further qualified as either evil or good, Utuku Limnu or Utuku Damku. Many of the terms referring to daimons in Mesopotamia recall the names of officials on earth, like Rabitsu, and they were readily individuated. Whereas in Egypt, the names point to a function of the entity as it related to the human world, for example, the murderers. And here, such terms were more typically interchangeable. Daimons were part of a much larger category of beings that have been labeled Zwischenwesen, or intermediaries, which also included such interstitial beings as the spirits of the dead, the roaming dead, various ghostly beings such as revenants, phantoms, and ancestral spirits, with which daimons may share similar functions despite their distinct origins, the dead only becoming Zwischenwesen following death. Finally, and this need be highlighted, daimons in both Egypt and Mesopotamia could undergo a process of deification and become the recipients of cult and sacrifice, just as deities might be demonized and transformed into demons as such. Now, narrowing our focus further, in the worlds of ancient Syria and Canaan, we have numerous incantations from the late Bronze Age city of Ugarit that are directed against, for example, the evil eye, snakes, scorpions, as well as an incantation in Akkadian designed to counter Lamashtu, one of the baby strangler demons, and another that countered Kanikatu, a similar demon. The term at Ugarit, Mukishu, refers to an incantation specialist, as might another term, Ta'iyu, incantation priest. The term Lakshatu is an incantation per se, and one tablet from Ugarit appears to be an amuletic tablet worn or carried by the person for protection. As it stands, these traditions share many of the aspects of the daimonic that we just reviewed for Egypt and Mesopotamia. The same applies with two incantations preserved on tablets discovered at Iron Age Arslantash in northern Syria. These amulets were once thought to be forgeries, but are now recognized widely as authentic. Here, too, the term Lakshatu indicates an incantation and a strangler demon, Kanikatu, is mentioned. Moving ever closer to the Cisjordanian context of Iron Age, second half of the Iron Age, Israel and Judah, we must mention the contemporary site of Deir Alla on the border between the Cis and Transjordan. Here we have preserved a textual reference to the Shedayin in the now famous plaster cast text written in ink and attributed to the seer Balaam, we know from the Hebrew Bible. We also have an intriguing depiction of a sphinx-like figure, probably a daimon, perhaps a Shaddai being, painted on the upper border of that same lengthy plaster cast. What seems safe to conclude is that the Shedayin are divine beings of one sort or another, as indicated by the close parallel term gods, or Elohim, in the introductory part of the text. Elohim is cognate to Hebrew Elohim, gods. We will have more say on this datum shortly, but for now let me sum up. Daimons can be generally categorized according to function and spatial orientation or habitat, and possibly social alienation. They may protect or punish, situate or roam. Pazuzu is a classic example of a daemon commonly described as doing evil, and that because of this, he can also serve as an apotropaeon. We now turn to the topic of Iron Age II, Israel and Judah, dating roughly again 1000 to 500 BCE. Contrary to recent protest, we do have compelling evidence that documents the widespread attestation of apotropaic magic in Israel and Judah for the Iron II period. To illustrate this, one need only consider a lone example, amuletic magic. What evidence do we have for amulets, their context, and their functions in early Israelite and Judean societies? To date, we have more than 12,000 amulets that have thus far been documented from the general time period and geographic orientation in question, the late Bronze to Iron Age Southern Levant. These have had relatively little impact, however, on investigations into the demonic world of ancient Israel and Judah. This is apparently the state of things, in spite of the three volumes of Christian Hermann's ongoing catalog of myriads of amulets from numerous archaeological sites throughout the Southern Levant. As the amuletic repertoire continues to increase with each archaeological excavation season, A major portion of that database testifies to a significant early Judahite and Israelite amuletic tradition. Hermann offers as an estimate of the approximate total for just the seal amulets alone, more than 10,000. He has cataloged another 2,000 or more that represent a wide range of other types of amulets. Those most prominent include the Ujit Eye amulets, numbering 530 or more, followed by the Pateke amulets, 250 plus, and the Bess amulets, 170 and growing. He also makes note of another 80 or so examples of the feline-headed figurine amulets that dominate in the South. His overall calculations indicate that the amuletic repertoire reached its peak in the Iron II period, and that the Iron IIb, not Iron IIc, was its highlight. A review of cultic assemblages from two representative sites illustrates the wide geographic distribution of amuletic magic in Israel and Judah during the Iron II period, in both domestic and mortuary environments. At Be'er Sheva, in the Iron II levels, we have a location preserved and that have preserved an unprecedented domestic cult assemblage consisting of a bronze Egyptian goddess figurine, a bronze bull figurine, a bronze Seth animal head, a bronze double crown amulet, faience beads, a bowl, a glass Phoenician style head, two stone cylinders, and two ostrich eggs. Another assemblage just a short distance away preserved the faience animal or sphinx figure seated on a pedestal, another amulet, a bone spout fragment, and a jug. At the city of Lachish, the Iron II tombs preserve 20 or so amulets alongside a range of anthropomorphic figurines, both Judean pillar figurines and horse rider figurines, weapons, animal figurines, zoomorphic vessels, and rattles. All of these, with the exception of the rattles, are also typical figurative ritual objects of Iron II Israelite Judahite domestic cult assemblages. With the precise nature of the cult activities reflected in such assemblages has long been the subject of much discussion, there can be little doubt that they had genuine cultic significance that entailed aspects of both divination and magic, comprising as they do game pieces for casting of lots, astragals for the purposes of divination, amulets, seals, and axe heads for apotropaic measures, and possibly figurines for necromantic rituals. These archaeological constructs provide a reliable index that highlights the wide distribution of apotropaic function of amulets, along with the many other objects in Israelite, Judahite, domestic, or tomb assemblages of the Iron II period. We can now add to that repertoire the impressive testimony of the Ketef Hinnom silver amulets. These amulets, recovered from a Jerusalem tomb chamber of the Iron II period, preserve some of our earliest explicit written verification of evil retrieved from an early Judean archaeological context, and I would add personified evil. These two amulets were designed for wearing around the neck as talismans, as indicated by their size and their form. That a world of the demonic was embraced in late Iron II Judean religion is now verified by not only the two readings of the term evil, Hebrew ra'ah, in inscriptions number 1 and number 2, but more specifically Yahweh's role as the exorcizer of evil in amulet number 2, and by the definite article prefixed to the reference to evil in amulet number 1, the evil. The meaning of the verb ga'ar, to expel, hex, or exorcise, used also in an incantation from Ugarit, here highlights the incantatory character of the inscriptions, as does the fact that the amulets were designed to be worn as such. Furthermore, that they were recovered from a Jerusalem tomb cultic assemblage indicates that such amulets designed to ward off evil were also employed as a specific form of mortuary or funerary ritual. These new readings and the Ketephonome amulets, when viewed alongside Christian Hermann's massive catalog of amulets spanning the whole of the Iron Age Southern Levant, point to a rather widespread fear of demons in Israel and Judah, and by inference, the extensive recourse to their counterparts, either other demons or angels functioning in an apotropaic manner. When we explore apotropaic magic closer in proximity to Ketephonome and in the immediate environs of Jerusalem itself, we find again a rich amuletic environment. Yet to my knowledge, these data, like the amuletic evidence more broadly, have not been given their proper due in treatments of the Ketephonome amulets. And again, Hermann has gathered in his catalog a number of intriguing amulets from Iron to Jerusalem, the location of the Ketephonome amulets. There is a feline-headed full-body amulet from the Ophel of Iron 2B, a grotesque male-headed glass amulet at Ketephonome itself from the Persian period, and one or possibly two Ujit-I amulets from Ketephonome of the Iron Sea, Iron 2C. Lastly, Hermann includes an amulet fragment found at Ketephonome comprised of part of a ceramic neck collar whose close parallels are those amulets depicting a female head with double-crowned headdress and identified as the Egyptian goddess Sakhmet or Bastet. We can now also add to Hermann's Iron II Jerusalem amulets those recovered in the 1995 excavations at the City of David. All of these, all three are Ujit-I amulets. Two have been dated to the Iron 2C, and the third to the Persian period. As Cahill adeptly points out, all three have their analogs in fact, tomb or funerary context, and several of those were recovered from Iron Age mortuary environments directly. I should add in this closing section, Gabriel Barkai recently indicates that the Ujit-I amulet from Ketephonome was found in the same tomb complex as the two silver amulets, that is, room number 25, and that they are all part of the same cultic assemblage. The apotropaic function of the Ujit-I amulet, used against the evil eye, further highlights the nefarious role that the evil mentioned in Ketephonome Amulet 1 must have played in the burial preparations for the deceased, as well as the need for Yahweh to take on the role as the exorciser of the evil in Ketephonome Amulet 2. To conclude, these three amulets from Ketephonome, the two silver-sheeted and the Ujit-I, were used conjointly to invoke the apotropaic powers needed to protect the dead, not only as the deceased rest in the grave, but more so subsequently as the dead began the journey to its netherworld destination. Finally, we take up our third line of evidence, the biblical traditions. Like our Egyptian, Mesopotamian, Syrian, and Canaanite written sources, biblical Hebrew has no single term for the types of numinous beings that we have provisionally denoted as daimons in the pre- or the non-Christian, or better, non-dualistic Greek sense of the term. Rather, we are confronted with a host of terms and concepts that experts have identified as prospective demons, or daimons. The Se'irim, the Ye'irim, the Tze'im, the Lilith, the Azazel, Deber, Ketev, Tanim, etc., etc., etc. Furthermore, there's a noticeable divide among interpreters precisely over what kind of demons these terms might represent, if they represent them at all, and whether they are demons as they are articulated within a dualistic framework, as we know from later Judaism and Christianity, or as they are daimons along the lines of those from the ancient Near East and from pre-Christian, non-Christian, or non-dualistic Greek sources we just surveyed. With the time I have allotted, it'd be most practical and productive if we examine one case in detail as a precis to what prospects might present themselves for future analysis. I've selected a well-worn text for examination, Deuteronomy 32:17. My provisional translation is as follows. They sacrificed to the Shedim, not to Eloah, gods whom they did not know, new ones that came along only recently. They had not feared them, your fathers. The mention of the Shedim in verse 17 has generated an impressive array of interpretations. Devils, demons, gods, or even none of the above, false gods. This is firstly because interpreters differ on the significance of the terms Eloah and Elohim in close proximity. Secondly, because of the supposed cognate to Hebrew Shedim in Akkadian, Shedu, namely the Mesopotamian Shedu or Lamassu spirits or demons, who the texts tell us were portrayed in the form of bulls as protectors of temples and palaces. And finally, because the later wholesale adoption of the Hebrew Shedim as a key term in much later Jewish and Aramean speculation about the demonic. The Shedim may also appear in a very similar context in the Iron II Deir Alec plaster cast inscription as the Shedaim, which I just mentioned above. But just like Deuteronomy 32:17, these divine beings are found parallel by the term for gods, the Elohim, in Deir Alec, which is that direct cognate to the Hebrew Elohim gods. The cognate term to Hebrew Shedim is Akkadian Shedu and is generally recognized as derivative of a triradical base, Shin Dalet Dalet, and that from Deir Alec from a different root, and that's the significance, Shin Dalet Yod. While this is intriguing, the proposal concerning the Yod is highly unusual, and there's been an elaborate argument in defense of it. Moreover, the Akkadian Shedu function both as protector and as demon, that is to say, in both good and evil ways. Even a quick review shows the term is qualified by the adjectival equivalents of good, damku, and bad, limnu. In several instances, though the latter might appear more frequently than the former. And while the Shedim in Deuteronomy 32 are not explicitly portrayed as good spirits or bad demons, the presumption that they were foreign gods is unwarranted, and the use of this suspect conclusion, in turn, to eliminate their connection to Akkadian Shedu, hardly seems compelling. That they are described as new, hadashim, previously unknown, lo, yedu'on, and ones that the forefathers had not feared, does not lead to the logical or necessary conclusion that these are foreign gods. In light of our survey of daimons in the ancient Near East, I would propose that the Shedim in Deuteronomy 32 more likely represent recently deified demons in an Israelite pantheon undergoing, or recently have undergone, transformation as part of an internal religious pluralistic process. As we pointed out previously, it is a well-attested phenomena that ancient Near Eastern demons in special circumstances and in various situations could be transformed or elevated to the level of gods. Thus, sacrifice and cult would accompany a daimon's elevated status. There's no need to falsify dichotomies between gods and daimons by reading much later dualistic concepts into an older tradition, text, or socio-historical context, or proposing highly exceptional historical linguistic explanations in the absence of corroborative evidence. So, texts like Deuteronomy 32:17 provide a window into developments that have their broad analogs in the proximate and dominant ancient Near Eastern cultures, namely, daimons can deify, deities might be demonized, and in either case, daimons could receive sacrifices. These cosmological worlds of the ancient Near East, filled with the daimons that these people imagined, as they interacted, adopted, adapted, engaged, and exchanged, simply were not static. In other words, our text is not addressing foreign deities or foreign syncretism. It depicts sacrifices offered to daimons, not demons, those intermediary beings who had been recently elevated in their status as gods from within a form of Israelite religion, an internal pluralistic Israelite religion, at odds with that of our author. Now, it may come as a surprise to find that the ancient Jewish Septuagint translator, who worked with the Hebrew Shedim into the Greek actually confirms their daimonic status rather than their demonic character. Let me be clear here on this point. The LXX renders Shedim here as daimonia. That is, in the non-Christian, non-dualistic Greek sense of the term, that I have used throughout this paper to refer to any and all divine beings. In fact, it is a Greek term used to translate a number of the various Hebrew terms that interpreters have identified as daimonic in the Hebrew Bible. While it might be a case of semantic leveling as opposed to semantic differentiation for our Septuagint translator, daimonia would include the high gods, intermediary beings, even ghosts, much like those daimons we surveyed from Egypt, Mesopotamia, Syria, and Canaan. And as I have proposed for Deuteronomy 32:17, it designates deified demons. In closing, a comparison of the Hebrew of the Masoretic text, or specifically the Leningrad Codex, with that of the Hebrew Vorlaga underlining the Greek text of Deuteronomy 32, Melvin Peters concluded in his 2010 personal reflections on the completed Deuteronomy translation into the Greek, the so-called new Septuagint translation. He states this: the Leningrad Codex readings are subsequent to those reflected by the Hebrew Vorlaga of the Greek Deuteronomy. In Deuteronomy 32:17, Greek daimonia, in its non-dualistic, broadest range of meaning, presents as a close approximate of Hebrew Shedim and Akkadian Shedu. And so we have come full circle. Thank you.